This hour's top stories. Iran's foreign minister reiterates that the revival of the 2015 agreement depends on the political decisions made by the other sides. Canadian police use pepper spray and stun grenades to clear Ottawa of anti-vaccine protesters who have occupied the city for more than 3 weeks. Also in the headlines, a suicide bomber kills over a dozen people in a popular restaurant packed with local officials and politicians in central Somalia.
Welcome to the program.
Iranian president says any Vienna deal must entail the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the provision of credible guarantees. Ebrahim Raisi made the remark in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. He said Iran continues the negotiations with seriousness and has offered constructive proposals. The president noted that Tehran has assessed the proposals but put forward by the other sides based on their conformity with the interests of the Iranian nation. Raisi also warned against any anti-Iran political pressures, saying such measures could weaken the prospects of reaching an agreement. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister, who is attending the Munich Security Conference, says the revival of the 2015 deal hinges on the political decisions made by the other sides.
Iran was deprived from all the promised economic benefits on the JCPOA. The Islamic Republic of Iran participated in the new round of Vienna negotiations in good faith and seriousness while tabling initiatives for achieving a good deal. I would like to emphasize here that we are ready to achieve a good deal at the earliest possible time if the other side makes the needed political decision.
Amir Abdullahian says Iran's demands, including a verifiable removal of all sanctions inconsistent with the JCPOA and guarantees for the fulfillment of commitments, are absolutely reasonable. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in intensive negotiations in Vienna to restore the agreement. Tehran wants a verifiable removal of the sanctions the U.S. imposed on Iran after Washington unilaterally left the deal in 2018. Political commentator Bijan Tabasoli says it is the United States that has to make political decisions and not Iran in order to salvage the 2015 deal.
But then we are now seeing signs of France, Germany, and even Great Britain coming over to this side and telling the Americans that it's their turn to make some moves now. That's a very significant development. And I think that it depends on the strength of the Biden administration, whether they are able to really make those moves. That, I mean, the majority of the staffers in the White House know that the onus is on them now. But I'm not sure whether they're strong enough to push it through domestically, even in their own party, even while they see that this is the only way forward. And the impetus is now on the American side because, as you well know, oil and gas prices are at record highs now. And so this is contributing to an inflationary environment in the United States that is really putting pressure on Democratic candidates in the 2022 elections. And so the party of Joe Biden could be gone in the election if they don't make this deal.
Canadian police have clashed with protesters in the capital, Ottawa, using pepper spray and stun grenades to disperse the weeks-long demonstrations against COVID restrictions.
Don't push back!
Move back!
The clashes come as security forces move closer to the hub of the anti-mandate protest that has gripped the city for 3 weeks. So far, more than 140 people have been arrested and dozens of vehicles seized over the past 2 days. Organizers of the so-called Freedom Convoy said they've asked trucks to withdraw because of heavy-handed police tactics. The massive crackdown comes as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to stop the protests. The demonstrations were started by Canadian truckers opposing any and actually order demanding unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. The protests have turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. Political commentator Kent Stone says the protests in Canada are being fueled by separatists in the country and provided for by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump supporters and allies.
Well, I have three things to say about the so-called freedom convoy. It has nothing to do with freedom. This protest was inspired by the former U.S. President Trump, Donald Trump, who subjected the Islamic Republic of Iran to a campaign of maximum pressure during his entire term of office. And he has encouraged and applauded this, so have some of his Republican governors in Texas and Florida, for example. He's encouraged people in the United States to give money, his supporters, and they have given a large part of the funding that went into this protest. In addition, the money comes as well from evangelical Christians in the United States. So the protest is not about freedom, and it is a right-wing fringe group that is leading these protests. This is their second convoy. They had one in 2019, and it was led by a woman, the same woman who's leading. Was just arrested yesterday, and she belongs to a Western separatist party which wants to break away Canada's Western provinces and join them with the United States.
At least 14 people are reported dead in a suicide bomb attack by Al-Shabaab Takfiri terrorists in the Somali city of Beledweyne. The attack targeted a popular restaurant on the eve of a round of parliamentary elections. According to local authorities, there have been government officials among the victims. More than 15 people have also been injured in the blast, which caused damage to nearby buildings. Police say the incident is the deadliest the area has ever witnessed. Somalia and mainly its capital, Mogadishu, has been the scene of growing attacks by Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab terrorists in recent weeks. Security checkpoints, police stations, and a convoy of parliamentary delegates have been some of their latest targets. That is while the African country is struggling to go through a long-delayed general election. Australia joins the club of U.S. allies that have designated the Palestine Resistance Movement, Hamas, as a terrorist organization. The Australian government says it takes issue with Hamas's ideologies. The following report sheds more light on why Australia targeted Hamas this time and why resistance groups are often targets of Western governments like that of the U.S.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations.
Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, among others, are all under sanctions by the West, and all they have done is standing up against the U.S. and Israel's crimes. Even though they enjoy massive popular support, the countries that have labeled them as terrorist organizations are themselves guilty of crimes, including war crimes. Take a look.
Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
The brewing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine seems to be boiling over. The crisis was the topic of our news review program earlier. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say.
Situation remains tense in eastern Ukraine amid renewed fighting between government troops and pro-Russian forces. Ukraine's military says the pro-Russia forces have opened fire on more than 20 settlements, killing two soldiers. Explosions have also been reported north of Donetsk City. A second exploded shell has been found on Russian territory near the Ukrainian border. Leader of pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine has ordered full troop mobilization over fears of an offensive. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Richard Becker, anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco, California, and Mr. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, joining us out of Bristol. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Mr. Becker, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in San Francisco, sir. Now, we see Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, saying, you know, he's still very open to dialogue, and he hopes he could speak more to the Russian leader. We've seen U.S. President Joe Biden basically saying that he hopes that more dialogue could avert the possibility of war. We've seen the Russian president saying that we are still open to dialogue to try to diffuse tensions, but we see all three of them speaking to cameras instead of each other. Why?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think that on the one hand, you have the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, saying they're open to negotiations. On the other hand, just yesterday, he's once again saying that Ukraine should join NATO and getting standing ovation for saying that. And, you know, so you have appears to be public relations, that is the call for negotiations, but at the same time pressing ahead with what the Russians have the greatest objection to, which is the possibility of Ukraine joining NATO. I don't think that can happen right now because I think there's opposition within NATO to doing it, and they have to have unanimity in order to accept a new state. But the fact that he keeps calling for Ukraine today in the New York Times, there's an article which I think really shows how mischaracterizing the Western media is in general, not just the Times, but the New York Times, the newspaper of record. It says that Russia looks at Ukraine as a buffer against the West, and the West looks at Ukraine as a buffer against Russia. This is a completely false way of presenting. And the reality is that it's not Russia that's been moving westward and surrounding Western Europe or any of the countries of Western Europe. Nothing like that has happened at all. But on the other hand, 14 new countries have been added to NATO since 1997. And most of those are former Soviet republics or countries that were part of the Warsaw Pact of the socialist bloc in Europe. So, I mean, this is the propaganda that we get. but we have to sort out what the reality is.
Tony, welcome to the program there, bud. Thanks for your patience. Now, Tony, to Richard's point, is that the only kind of negotiations that the West is open to? One that ends with NATO on the Ukrainian border with Russia 10 meters to the other side of it?
Well, look, there's two massive aspects of unreality to what's been going on over the last few weeks. We've had wall-to-wall propaganda right throughout the Western press saying, oh, Putin's about to invade. Hang on, is it today? Is it tomorrow? Actually, of course, what's happening is that the Russians have been doing manoeuvres on the border because the Ukrainians have actually been doing some operations of their own. And so there is no problem whatsoever with the Russians on the Ukrainian-Russian border or doing joint exercises in Belarus, for example, doing exercises within their own territory because they're feeling threatened. It's what Britain would do. You know, say, for example, there were troops on the border of Scotland threatening to invade England, you know, for example. So that is totally unreal to say they're about to invade just because there are troops on the border. That's just simply not the case. And then also this other aspect, even bigger of unreality, is with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989. In 1980, the US Secretary of State James Baker promised, he said that NATO will not move one inch, or I think maybe he said a mile, anyway, a very short distance eastwards. We will not do it. And this was a solemn promise made at the time that the Berlin Wall fell to reassure the world that this was really going to be a peace dividend and that there was going to be no more resumption of the Cold War.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe. Richard Becker from San Francisco, California. Mr. Tony Gosling there joining us out of Bristol. Thanks for tuning in for this segment of your news review program. And bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
All those trillions of dollars consumed in wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A pessimism spawned by corporate elites increasingly consumed by greed, says William Astore, a writer, in an article published under the heading, 60 Years of War-Making May Yet Result in the Destruction of U.S. Democracy. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Speaking of George Orwell, America's 60-year war, a losing proposition for the many, proved a distinctly winning one for the few, and that wasn't an accident either. In his book Within a Book in 1984, Orwell wrote all too accurately of permanent war as a calculated way of consuming the products of modern capitalism without generating a higher standard of living for its workers. That, of course, is the definition of win-win situation for the owners. In his words, the essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces or pouring into the a stratosphere, or sinking in the depth of the sea, materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. Even when weapons of war are not actually destroyed, their manufacture is still a convenient way of expending labor power without producing anything that can be consumed by the workers. War was a way of making huge sums of money for a few at the expense of the many, who would be left in a state where they simply couldn't fight back or take power, ever. Think of such war production and war making as a legalized form of theft, as Icke recognized in 1953 in his Cross of Iron speech against militarism. The production of weaponry he declared 8 years before he named the military-industrial complex in the U.S. constituted theft from those seeking a better education, affordable healthcare, safer roads, or indeed any of the fruits of a healthy democracy, attuned to the needs of its workers. And war was also a way to stimulate the economy without stimulating hopes and dreams, a way to create wealth for the few while destroying it for the many. Domestically, the Vietnam War crippled Lyndon Johnson's plans for the Great Society. The high cost of the failed war and of Pentagon budgets that continue to rise today regardless of results are now cited as arguments against Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's new ideal, arguably, would have never been funded if today's vast military-industrial complex, or even the one in Icke's day, had existed in the 1930s. As political theorist Crane Brinton noted in The Anatomy of Revolution, a healthy and growing middle class, equal parts optimistic and opportunistic, is likely to be open to progressive, even revolutionary ideas. But a stagnant, shrinking, or slipping middle class is likely to prove politically reactionary as pessimism replaces optimism and protectionism replaces opportunity. In this sense, the arrival of Donald Trump in the White House was anything but a mystery and the possibility of an autocratic future no less so. All those trillions of dollars consumed in the wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A sign of it is the near total absence of the very idea of peace as a shared possibility for the U.S. Most Americans simply take it for granted that war or threats of war having a defined immediate past will define the future as well. As a result, soaring military budgets are seen not as aberrations, nor even as burdensome, but as unavoidable, even desirable, a sign of national seriousness and global material superiority. It should be mind-blowing that despite the wealth being created and often destroyed by the United States and impressive gains in worker productivity, the standard of living for workers hasn't increased significantly since the early 1970s. One thing is certain, it hasn't happened by accident. For those who profit most from it, America's 60-year war has indeed been a resounding success, even if also a colossal failure when it comes to worker prosperity or democracy. This really shouldn't surprise us. As former President James Madison warned Americans so long ago, no nation can protect its freedoms amid constant warfare. Democracies don't die in darkness. They die in and from war. In case you hadn't noticed, evidence of the approaching death of American democracy is all around Americans. It's why so many of Americans are profoundly uneasy. They are, after all, living in a strange new world, worse than that of their parents and grandparents, one whose horizons continue to contract while hope contracts with them. And here's what worries most of all. America's very long war of destruction against relatively weak countries and peoples may be over, or at least reduced to the odd moment of hostilities. But America's leaders, no matter the party, now seem to favor a new Cold War against China and now Russia. Incredibly, the old Cold War produced a win that was so sweet yet so fleeting that it seems to require a massive do-over. Promoting war may have worked well for the military-industrial complex when the enemy was thousands of miles away with no capacity for hitting the homeland. If a war with China or Russia or both comes to pass, it won't be a long one. And count on one thing. America's leaders, corporate, military, and political won't be able to shrug off the losses by looking at positive balance sheets and profit margins at weapons factories.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and here are some thought-provoking words that will surely benefit all of us, as expounded by the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, as he used to say when passing by markets. O tradesman, seek good from God before doing anything else. Seek blessing by dealing with people leniently. Come near to the purchasers. Adorn yourselves with clemency. Avoid swearing. Avoid telling lies. Be away from oppression. Be fair with the oppressed. Do not approach usury. Give a full measure. Weigh things with a right balance. Do not wrong men of their things. And do not act corruptly in earth, making mischief.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for tuning in and thank you for listening to this program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Now, brothers and sisters, in this episode, I'm going to discuss with you another stage of nafs. In the previous two or three episodes, I discussed the different levels of nafs. I talked about the importance of self-knowledge, first of all, and then I talked about nafsi amara, and then nafsi lawama, and then we have the nafsi mutmainna, which we are going to explore in this stage. Now, nafsi mutmainna, of course, has been translated as the secure self or the certain self. You know, some people have translated as soul in complete rest and complete satisfaction. There is a verse in the Holy Quran, verse 27 and 28 of Surah Al-Fajr, which you can read, for yourself, but I will read it for you. يَا أَيَّتُهَا النَّفْسُ الْمُطْمَئِنَّ إِرْجَعِ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكِ رَاضِيَةً مَرْضِيَّ. O thou soul, in complete rest and satisfaction, return to your Lord, well-pleased with Him, well-pleasing Him. So the main point which we are going to talk about and elaborate is an-nafsul mutmainna. Dear brothers and sisters, it's important to know ourselves to understand His relationship to Allah. He who knows himself has known his Lord. This is what we talked in the previous episode. The verse of the Holy Quran, which I just recited, refers to yet another level of nafs, which is nafsi mutmainna, or the nafs which is at rest. It is the nafs which is at peace. It is the self or the nafs that has ascended to the first station of development towards intimacy, contentment, and love for Allah. Nafsi mutmainna is the nafs whose refinement is attained through increasing commitment and through honest and sincere fulfillment of obligations with respect to the true way. Now, the human soul, the human nafs, at this stage is set on the right path, and it is traversing the path towards perfection, the path towards goodness and virtue. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Nafsi mutmainna, or the secure self, has entered the pathways, the methods and means of protection and healing through self-examination, resistance and striving and devotion. That is where this nafsi mutmainna is, because it has come all the way from nafsi amara, from nafsi lawama, to nafsi mutmainna. You know, it is in a position to examine itself, to heal itself, and to resist, to strive, and to devote. These efforts bear the fruit of certainty in the truth that Allah alone is the actor. Allah alone is the Lord, is the sustainer, and Allah alone is the provider. He is the whole and sole actor. He is the cause and motivator of everything, because there is no God but Him, and no Lord but Him. And of course, Allah in all of His actions is merciful and generous. He knows the best interests of the nafs or self. Now this certainty, this itminan, of course, which comes from the nafs, leads to trust in Allah. The self, the nafs, becomes confident that what is with Allah is better and more enduring than whatever is in the position of nafs or in the position of others. So the self becomes secure and ceases to occupy itself with anything other than Allah, the Almighty. So it's occupied with Allah and it rests in peace. It is certain. And that's why it's called nafs mutmainna. And of course, the Urafa, the mystics, and of course, Shi'i scholars have gone to a great length explaining this level of nafs. Allama Tabatabai, for example, considers this nafs, nafs mutmainna, or maybe the confident soul or nafs, to be one that has attained peace by relying on God. It is satisfied with God's pleasure, and it is satisfied with the ups and downs of life. And these ups and downs of life have no effect on it. Everybody obviously has ups and downs. There are bitter experiences, there are happy experiences. But these experiences have no effect on the nafs. Now, such a person with such a soul, with such a nafs, is in complete servitude and does not deviate from the right path. This is the characteristic of the nafsi mutmainna, or the secure self. Now you can go, if you understand, of course, tafsir, the Farsi or Arabic, you can go to Al-Mizan, volume 20, page 285. Unfortunately, the tafsir Al-Mizan has not been completely translated. The translation is underway and it is being translated. The first few volumes have been translated thanks to some great scholars who have endeavored to translate this voluminous book, Tafsir, of course. Nafs mutmainna is the first level of maturity for the self. The heart begins to shine with the light of consciousness. The ego's power begins to shrink so that purity, refinement, clarity, and light dominate the heart. The self begins to show its true attributes that were previously hidden. These are the attributes of servitude, or budiyya, you know, helplessness, ajz, you know. All the power belongs to Allah. And these are attributes of humility, the attribute of poverty, you know, non-attachment, faqr. And these are the attributes of need, ihtiyaj, and annihilation, fana. You know, these are some very concepts which someone who understands and who covers the stages and levels of the nafs reaches a level where he considers himself as someone who is annihilated, and who is completely poor, who is completely helpless, and who considers himself as being a pure servant. Now, he is under the command of his human soul, which takes pleasure in following the example of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. He possesses the qualities which Allah praises. He is kind, he is generous, he is patient, he is forgiving, he is sincere, thankful, he is content, and he is at peace. Now, the self is characterized by all these positive attributes at this level of the nafs, and which is why it is at peace. The nafs is constantly remembering Allah, and it is tranquil, it is at peace. Allah bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub. And that's another verse which you can find in the Quran. In short, brothers and sisters, an nafs al-mutmainna is the noblest and highest soul compared to other stages, because this soul is, this nafs is always in the truth without the slightest doubt. That's all for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with the light.
The City of London usually welcomes arts and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
Well, I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings, and the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix of fusion of different music, and that's always interesting, and it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy, and like, yeah, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Axolotls are unique Mexican amphibians at risk of extinction, and many conservation programs are now trying to save these strange-looking animals. An ecological park in Mexico City is the latest place to celebrate them. It has held a ceremony for releasing baby axolotls into their natural habitat, which is the mud. These amphibians are so special that even a number of city officials attended the event. Conservationists say having a clean environment is key to their survival.
I've managed to breed up to 22,000 axolotls. In all of Xochimilco, there are 90 axolotls across 90 kilometers, but the quality of the axolotls depends on the quality of biologist you are. Bad quality water has killed anywhere from 12,000 to 15,000.
Researchers have discovered that axolotls can absorb oxygen from the surface of their skin and are therefore more vulnerable to dirty water and environments. More than 70 breeding centers across Mexico have joined the rally of saving these critically endangered species. Many are even marketing them as ideal pets. But to animal advocates, keeping axolotls as pets is a definite no-no.
Now, for those who are interested in archaeology, the remains of 14 mummies have been unearthed at an ancient site in central Peru. The mummies, believed to be over 1,000 years old, include 6 children and 8 adults. The tomb containing the bodies was found at an archaeological complex about 25 kilometers from the capital, Lima. Researchers discovered other objects such as clay pots, decorated calabashes, and some knitting gears near the mummies. They believe the children and adults were sacrificed in honor of a prominent local figure whose mummified body was found last November in the same area. Van Dalen says the discovery provides them with the oldest evidence of child sacrifice associated with the burial of an elite character in the pre-Inca era. The city of Cajamarquia, which was built out of mud in around 200 BC, is considered as one of the largest archaeological complexes in Peru.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he's of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
An Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tire using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic prop with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tire would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
Biologists in Peru release 2 birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. 2 birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the affected coast close to the capital, Lima. So far, several species have been released after rehabilitation. An oil tanker off the coast of Peru was hit by waves triggered by a volcanic eruption miles away in Tonga in January. Some 6,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean that polluted waters and beaches along Peru's Pacific coast.
There are all sorts of peculiar restaurants around the world, but not so many prison-themed eateries. One of them is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and it is thriving.
The setting is engaging. If we want to suggest it to someone, it's because of the setting, too. It's like a cell, both its title and the story of the owners. They wrote here they were inmates themselves and why they were in jail.
Cell 16 serves its customers in cells where they can wear mock prison uniforms. The owners say they got the idea for their diner while they were behind bars for debt. They say they are now open to help newly released inmates who find it hard to get employed and give out part of their proceeds to pay for debt inmates.
There have been several cases where an inmate came and worked here while on leave, and we helped and offered him money to help his problem.
The eatery was opened in 2016. The owners have now expanded their business and own two diners in Tehran and another in the central city of Isfahan. They say they are using their emerging restaurant chain to raise funds to free convicts who are serving time for unpaid debts.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital, Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered 5 traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. The cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the games.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Massive study shows a long-term substantial rise in risk of cardiovascular disease, including heart attack and stroke, after a SARS-CoV-2 infection, according to an article published in the Nature. This article is titled, Heart Disease Risk Soars After COVID, Even with a Mild Case. Stay tuned for more. Even a mild case of COVID-19 can increase a person's risk of cardiovascular problems for at least a year after diagnosis, a new study shows. Researchers found that rates of many conditions, such as heart failure and stroke, were substantially higher in people who had recovered from COVID-19 than in similar people who hadn't had the disease. What's more, the risk was elevated even for those who were under 65 years of age and lacked risk factors such as obesity and diabetes. It doesn't matter if you are young or old. It doesn't matter if you smoked or you didn't, says study co-author Ziad Al-Ali at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and the chief of research and development for the Veterans Affairs St. Louis healthcare system. He added, the risk was there. Al-Ali and his colleagues based their research on an extensive health record database curated by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. The researchers compared more than 150,000 veterans who survived for at least 30 days after contracting COVID-19 with two groups of uninfected people. A group of more than 5 million people who used the VA medical system during the pandemic, and a similarly sized group that used the system in 2017 before SARS-CoV-2 was circulating. People who had recovered from COVID-19 showed stark increases in 20 cardiovascular problems over the year after infection. For example, they were 52% more likely to have had a stroke than the contemporary